and Black communities, where we are scapegoated when it's convenient, and then we are thrown under the bus when it's convenient. And otherwise, it's, you know, show up to the polls to help us stay in power because we can't get elected without you. And that's a dynamic that has to end. When it's time to try to scapegoat and talk about, you know, why did Trump do better, then they want to talk about Black men. When it's time to talk about the issues and why 80% of Black men turned out to vote for Biden, no one wants to talk about defunding the police. That's a dynamic that has to end. And I think the last thing I would say is it's important for everyone to recognize that the Black movement, the Black organizing of our communities, that is independent of the Democratic Party. We are interacting with party politics, but this movement began during the Obama administration. It continued through the Trump administration, and it will continue through the Biden administration. We're not altering our agenda based on what the Democratic leadership
decides. We have to leave it there, and I thank you so much for being with us, Bree Newsom Bass, anti-racist activist, and Princeton professor Eddie Glaude. Happy birthday to John Hamilton and Karen Crib Meadows. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives you a little back in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies. Available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. And thanks.
There's so much that we need to share, so send a smile and show you care.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown has rescinded her order for Law Enforcement Joint Incident Command, Trump fires Defense Secretary Mark Esper, and drug maker Pfizer says their COVID-19 vaccine is 90% effective. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 9th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. On Saturday, as Americans reacted to Joe Biden's defeat of Donald Trump, hundreds of people gathered in Portland. The events included a spontaneous celebration downtown, a Black Lives Matter march in Southwest Portland, and heavily policed opposing demonstrations outside the state capitol in Salem. About 200 people gathered around the Capitol building in Salem to rally for Trump after multiple news outlets declared Biden's victory on Saturday. In Southwest Portland, Black Lives Matter demonstrators marched along Multnomah Boulevard and through Multnomah Village. The previously planned Break the White Silence march drew a crowd of about 300 people. Late Sunday, a small group shattered windows and graffitied the exterior of the Multnomah County Democrats' headquarters in Northeast Portland. Images from the scene showed the building was tagged with expletives directed at President-elect Joe Biden and the phrase, quote, "No presidents." The group had gathered at Laurelhurst Park before marching to the building on Northeast Sandy Boulevard. Police said the group quickly left the area, but three people were arrested on suspicion of criminal mischief. The demonstration came just hours after Governor Kate Brown withdrew her order placing Portland protest response under the joint command of the Oregon State Police and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office in anticipation of potential unrest in the days after the election. Earlier on Sunday, the Democratic Party of Oregon's headquarters in Northeast Portland was also spray-painted with the word shame. Newly elected City Commissioner Mingus Mapps joined other community leaders in denouncing vandalism brought upon fellow lawmaker Commissioner Dan Ryan following last week's City Council overturning of a massive Portland Police Bureau budget cut. A group of protesters gathered in front of Ryan's North Portland home last Thursday, causing a disturbance after he, along with Commissioner Amanda Fritz and Mayor Ted Wheeler, voted down a proposed $18 million budget cut to the PPB in last week's City Council meeting. A window was smashed and minor damage was done to Ryan's property, resulting in police dispersing the group early Thursday night. Ryan's no vote was the deciding factor in opposing Commissioner Joanne Hardesty's proposed police budget cut, despite previous campaign promises that he would support police reform. Mapps held a video conference on Friday afternoon, joined by a dozen other Black community leaders, calling out protesters who Mapps says have waged a, quote, campaign of intimidation and vandalism against Ryan for stalling on police budget reform. Criticizing protesters for bullying Ryan for his vote, Mapps compared the incident to intimidation Black voters have endured over time, saying, quote, "I know what it's like for a mob to roll up on your house in the middle of the night because you had the audacity to vote." Others joining Mapps in the outcry include former Trailblazer and University of Portland coach Terry Porter, former Multnomah County Commissioner Loretta Smith, Multnomah Education Service District Board member Denise Peterson, and community activist James Posey. When asked about the vandalism, Ryan commented that he is committed to listening and talking with protesters, but condemned bullying and intimidation tactics. Earlier Friday, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty joined Mayor Wheeler in denouncing the acts of vandalism towards Ryan, calling them unproductive and ineffective, saying, quote, "lines have been crossed." Oregon Governor Kate Brown announced on Sunday that she would be rescinding her executive order for Joint Incident Command following a weekend of largely peaceful demonstrations. Brown was anticipating post-election related unrest, and her order tasked state troopers, sheriff's deputies, and local police under a unified command structure last week to help safeguard the public. The order also authorized the use of the Oregon National Guard to help law enforcement locally if necessary. In Sunday's statement, Brown said, quote, "Free and fair elections and a peaceful transfer of power are hallmarks of our democracy. Whether you voted for the current president or the president-elect, we are all Americans. Now the hard work begins to heal the divisions in our nation," end quote. After polls closed on November 3rd, some friction was evidenced at a demonstration in downtown Portland, where some protesters smashed windows and clashed with officers, where 10 arrests were eventually made. Similarly, officers intervened at a confrontation Sunday morning at the state capitol in Salem, where opposing protest groups contended with each other, resulting in 4 arrests. Brown's order was set to expire at 5 p.m. on Sunday evening, but was instead rescinded around noon. On Monday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 723 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of cases up to 51,155. Oregon health officials also reported that 4 more Oregonians have died due to COVID-19, raising the state's death toll to 734 people. Governor Brown announced a return to restrictions on certain gatherings Friday after Oregon and the United States both saw record new COVID-19 cases and related deaths. Oregon is one of 10 states that saw a 50% or more increase in new cases last week. Not a single state decreased new cases by even 10%. While the nation surpassed 100,000 new daily cases multiple days last week, Oregon reported a record high of 988 new cases on Saturday. Saturday's numbers broke records set on Thursday, indicating the state is on a steep incline that experts worry may lead to hospitals being at capacity with COVID patients. In response to these upward trends, Governor Brown announced Friday that she was implementing a 14-day pause on social activities in at least 5 Oregon counties. The pause temporarily bans visitors at long-term care facilities, suggests working from home, limits restaurant capacity to 50 people, including restaurant staff, and caps gym capacities at 50 people. It also encourages Oregonians not to socialize with people outside their households and recommends masks and limits of 6 people per gathering for in-person meetings that cannot be avoided. It is these kinds of gatherings, small private parties and meetups among family and friends, that officials say are most responsible for recent spikes. There are no new restrictions on religious gatherings. The counties under these new regulations include Baker, Clackamas, Jackson, Lynn, Malheur, Marion, Multnomah, Umatilla, Union, and Washington. The pause begins Wednesday, November 11th, and will be lifted November 25th, the day before Thanksgiving. Washington State also recently set a new daily record for coronavirus cases with 1,777 new confirmed cases announced on Saturday. The update brings Washington's totals to more than 116,000 confirmed cases and 2,439 deaths. Nationally, over 10 million people in the United States have been infected with the novel coronavirus. More than 238,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 111,000 new cases per day, an increase of 59% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 50.7 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.2 million people have died across the world. The drug company Pfizer said on Monday that an early look at data from its coronavirus vaccine shows it is more than 90% effective. The interim analysis looked at the first 94 confirmed cases of COVID-19 among the more than 43,000 volunteers who received either 2 doses of the vaccine or a placebo. It found that fewer than 10% of infections were in participants who had been given the vaccine, while more than 90% of the cases were in people who had been given a placebo. The vaccine is being made with German partner BioNTech and requires 2 doses. In a news release, the pharmaceutical giant said it plans to seek emergency use authorization from the FDA as soon as volunteers have been monitored for 2 months after getting their second dose of the vaccine. Pfizer said it anticipates reaching that marker by the third week of November. The Pfizer vaccine uses messenger RNA to trick cells into producing bits of protein that look like pieces of the virus. The immune system learns to recognize and attack those bits and in theory would react fast to any actual infection. Pfizer said Monday it will evaluate whether the vaccine protects people against severe COVID-19 and whether the vaccine can provide long-term protection against the virus, even in patients who have been infected before. Pfizer expects to have 50 million vaccine doses available globally this year and 1.3 billion next year. U.S. Secretary for Housing and Urban Development and member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, Ben Carson, has tested positive for COVID-19 on Monday. Carson reportedly went to Walter Reed National Military Medical Center for the test, but has since returned home. Carson has received criticism for not taking the coronavirus seriously, as he is a neurosurgeon and a member of the medical community. Last week, he traveled to battleground states and attended multiple election events in close proximity to members of the public and prominent elected officials. He was also at the White House election night party, attended by over 400 people, most of whom, including Carson, did not wear a mask. Dr. Carson joins 6 other staffers and people close to the president's administration to be diagnosed with the virus in the second White House outbreak in just over a month. Last week, President Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, announced he tested positive for the virus. Meadows was also present at the election night party. Carson's deputy chief of staff, Coulter Baker, told ABC News, quote, "He is in good spirits and feels fortunate to have access to effective therapeutics which aid and markedly speed his recovery." Just 6 days after the election, Donald Trump has fired Secretary of Defense Mark Esper. Trump made the announcement on Twitter, writing, quote, "I am pleased to announce that Christopher C. Miller, the highly respected director of the National Counterterrorism Center, unanimously confirmed by the Senate, will be acting Secretary of Defense effective immediately. Chris will do a great job. Mark Esper has been terminated. I would like to thank him for his service," end quote. Esper had been at odds with Trump for months, and reports have circulated for several weeks that Trump was preparing to fire him after the election. Esper had publicly contradicted Trump over the administration's response to protests against racial injustice over the summer. Esper said in June that he did not support invoking the Insurrection Act to deploy active duty military troops to the streets to mitigate unrest. Esper also differed with Trump over the display of Confederate emblems and names at military installations. Trump was angered after Esper had expressed openness to renaming 10 military bases named after Confederate generals. And Esper circumvented Trump on disallowing the display of the Confederate battle flag at U.S. military installations. Miller will now take over as acting Secretary of Defense. You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for Coast Range Radio, talking about the Oregon Green New Deal and our industrial forests. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 50. Today in history, in 1965, the Great Northeast Blackout occurred as all of New York State, portions of 7 neighboring states, and parts of eastern Canada were plunged into darkness. The blackout began at the height of rush hour, delaying millions of commuters, trapping 800,000 people in New York subways, and stranding thousands more in office buildings, elevators, and trains. The quote of the day is from American writer and activist James Baldwin, who said, quote, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." After unprecedented voter turnout for the November 3rd election, the focus of the nation will shift to the state of Georgia, where 2 Senate seats remain unfilled. Soon, Georgia voters will have runoff elections to not only fill these seats, but also to decide which party will take majority control of the U.S. Senate. As it currently stands, 96 of 100 Senate seats are filled. 2 of the 4 missing seats, one in North Carolina and one in Alaska, will likely be filled by Republican candidates once all ballots are counted. With those positions filled, the Republican Party would represent a total of 50, or half, of all Senate seats. In order for Democrats to achieve that same representation, voters in Georgia would need to cast their votes in favor of Democratic leadership in the upcoming January 5th runoff election. With a 50-50 tie in the Senate, any split decisions would go to a tie-breaking vote of now Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. To win a Senate seat in Georgia, a candidate must win more than 50% of all votes in a general election. In November, no candidate achieved this majority, which forced the runoff election for both seats. In one race, Republican David Perdue faces Democrat John Ossoff. In the other, Republican Kelly Loeffler faces Democrat Raphael Warnock. The results of the runoff election in Georgia will play a large role in determining strategies and potential compromises between both parties. With Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in the White House and Democrats projected to hold a majority in the House, majority control of the Senate for either party will dictate what can be accomplished in the next 4 years. The presidential race has been called for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and they're getting ready for the transition. Plus, Colorado is the latest state to join the National Popular Vote Compact. With more on those stories, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talk.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
I'll work as hard for those who didn't vote for me as those who did. Let this grim era of demonization in America begin to end here and now.
President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris are focused on the transition to a new administration. Biden's expected to announce movement on his COVID-19 plan today. The first woman vice president, Harris will also be the first Black and biracial VP. In a salute to women suffragists, she wore white for her first remarks as VP-elect. She spoke about her Indian American mother.
And about the generations of women, Black women, Asian, white, Latina, Native American women, who throughout our nation's history have paved the way for this moment.
The machinery of elections will grind away until January 20th, says Georgetown law professor Joshua Geltzer.
December 8th, federal safe harbor deadline. December 14th, the Electoral College. January 3rd, a new Congress gets sworn in. January 6th, the joint session happens under the 12th Amendment, and the votes get open, the slates from the different states, and to the extent there's any disputes left, they're resolved.
The Trump campaign has filed about a dozen new lawsuits this past week, President Trump's falsely claiming voter fraud. So far, many prominent Republicans have either stayed quiet or followed suit, but notable exceptions include Senators Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and his brother George W. Bush, the only living former GOP president. In the world of sports, the Washington, D.C. Nationals have already invited Biden to throw out the first pitch in April. As of last night, Biden had 20 more than the required 270 electoral votes. He's gotten over 4 million votes more than President Trump nationwide. Pat Rosenstiel, a Republican with the National Popular Vote campaign, says retiring the Electoral College would benefit Americans of all parties.
The system's crashing under its own weight. You know, and the truth is it's not about the candidates, right? It's about the system. The system ends to indecisive results, which lends to chaotic messes, and we need to end that for 2024.
So far, five American presidents have lost the popular vote. Colorado is the latest state to join the National Popular Vote Compact, meaning they've agreed to send their 9 electoral votes to the candidate who wins the most votes nationally. The compact won't go into effect unless it's approved by enough states to get 74 electoral votes more. With Vice President-elect Harris as a potential tiebreaker in the Senate, the nation's eyes are on Georgia's January 5th runoff. Democrat John Ossoff against incumbent David Perdue. And here's Reverend Raphael Warnock, who's running against Republican Kelly Loeffler in a special election.
We've got 2 Senate seats in the runoff right here in the state of Georgia. That means that the road to flipping the Senate blue runs right through our state.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service and produced for television by Free Speech TV, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
By 2021, receipts from Target will no longer be coated with bisphenol A or bisphenol S, which are chemicals that have been linked to endocrine health issues. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Big box retailer Target has announced that it will eliminate toxic chemicals from its receipts by the end of the year. The company will stop using bisphenol S and bisphenol A, which are what give a shiny coating to thermal paper used for many airline tickets and receipts from stores and ATMs. Leah Segedy is a consumer watchdog with the website mamavation.com. She says the move will make millions of Americans safer.
A lot of health impacts have been linked to bisphenol, like diabetes, weight gain, asthma, infertility, hyperactivity in children, and lots of cancers like breast cancer and prostate cancer.
Mamavation gathered 51,000 signatures to petition Target to make the change. CVS, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, and Best Buy also have stopped using the chemicals known as BPA and BPS, which are known to be endocrine disruptors. BPA has gotten a lot of negative attention in recent years, yet it is still very common, embedded in food and beverage cans, polycarbonate plastic, children's toys, and garden hoses. Some companies responded by replacing BPA with BPS. However, Segedy notes that multiple new studies warn that BPS also is hazardous, especially because the powder rubs off and can be easily absorbed through the skin.
If you're a woman or if you're a child, your exposure level is actually higher because your skin is thinner than a man. So men's exposure would be lower.
Advocates say the change will be particularly beneficial to pregnant cashiers who handle receipts all day long. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Native people react to Joe Biden claiming victory as president and the Metlakatla Indian community locks down due to COVID-19. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As vote tallies from key states came in over the weekend, Joe Biden claimed victory as president of the United States. Biden and running mate Kamala Harris both mentioned Native Americans in speeches to the nation Saturday. Native people across the country were among those reacting to election projections. Carol Cadu Blackwood from Lawrence, Kansas, was a Democratic National Convention delegate. She's hopeful a Biden administration would work on efforts to end violence against women.
I work in the field of sexual violence and domestic violence education, awareness, and prevention. So I can see where they're going to push and promote VAWA and then and I'm excited to see the implementation of the Savannah's Act.
Danielle Steele from Atlanta, Georgia, says she's excited to see a woman of color as vice president.
You know, having people of color in these leadership positions, it matters, because even if it's not, you know, a native, like, we see the things that we can be and we can do.
James Brew is from the Fort Berthold Reservation.
I'm feeling a little more upbeat about where the country could potentially go. I live in North Dakota, and the oil industry has been pretty much the driving force behind economics here for a decade or so. And it's fair to say my tribe has benefited from oil and gas development, but the environment and other facets of our lives as indigenous people have suffered, unfortunately. But I am looking forward to responsible development of our resources, as well as more protections.
The Native vote is credited for record turnout across the country and in key states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Arizona. Biden and Harris have promised Native Americans would have a seat at the table in their administration. President Trump has not conceded defeat in the presidential election. Alaska's only reservation locked down over the weekend. That's after officials with Metlakatla Indian Community announced the Southeast Alaska Village's first COVID-19 case. Eric Stone reports.
With strict travel protocols in place, Metlakatla avoided the coronavirus for nearly 8 months after it arrived in nearby Ketchikan in March. But that streak ended last week. A 72-hour lockdown took effect Friday. Judith Eaton is Metlakatla Indian Community's secretary.
The general public must quarantine at home until the contact tracing procedures are completed.
Officials say the unnamed positive individual was immediately isolated after receiving their test results. Local and state health authorities are investigating the source of the infection. Classes at Metlakatla schools were canceled Friday, and several businesses announced that they would close, but Metlakatla's primary grocery store remains open. Face masks and six-foot distancing are now mandatory in public settings throughout the Annette Islands Reserve. Eden asks residents to abide by a few simple steps.
Wear your mask, wash your hands, be safe, be aware.
Ketchikan is seeing its highest case numbers since the pandemic began. It shares a twice-daily ferry link with Metlakatla. Non-essential travel to and from the reserve is currently restricted, and even essential workers are required to quarantine for 5 days. Lockdown restrictions were projected to end on Monday. I'm Eric Stone.
The National Congress of American Indians is hosting its 2020 annual convention and marketplace virtually this week. The six-day event includes discussions on COVID-19, economic recovery, the Native vote, Indian mascots, and many other topics. The focus of this year's convention is Truth and Reconciliation, to explore the state of tribal sovereignty and government-to-government relationships with the United States. The virtual marketplace features arts and crafts, tribal entities, nonprofits, and government agencies. A cultural night will be hosted by the affiliated tribes of the Northwest Indians. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Wildfire smoke leaves people more vulnerable to COVID-19, so it's important for people in fire-prone regions to minimize exposure to the virus and to avoid smoke. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. This year, wildfires have raged across many parts of the western United States, filling the air with smoke. As a result, communities are experiencing dangerous air pollution at the same time that they are dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. And researchers say breathing that smoky air can make people more vulnerable to COVID-19. Sarah Henderson is with the British Columbia Center for Disease Control.
Your body perceives that smoke as a foreign threat, the same way it would perceive a virus or a bacterium, and it mounts an immunological response against the smoke, trying to kill it, basically. And what this serves to do is kind of distract your immune system.
The smoke also makes cilia, tiny hair-like structures that help keep our lungs and airways clean, less effective.
That means that virus that makes it into your body may not get cleared out of your body as efficiently as it normally would.
So Henderson says it's especially important for people in fire-prone regions to minimize their exposure to COVID-19 and take precautions to avoid smoky air. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 9th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Hendrik Brokelschen, Samantha Law, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonio Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage in Studio. Host Dime Roberts speaks with Ajay Terrazas Tripathi, a Portland actor, director, producer, and playwright who is collaborating on two Shakespeare virtual projects. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and critics about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of these KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. Have you been enjoying the show or have some questions? Send me an email at andrew@coastrange.org. To hear past episodes, visit coastrange.org/coastrangeradio. You can also listen to Coast Range Radio wherever you find your podcasts. On this episode, we interview Chuck Willer. Chuck is the executive director of the Coast Range Association, and in this episode, we discuss Chuck's work on climate change and the role Oregon's industrial forests play in a Green New Deal transition to a carbon-free society. Hey, Chuck, thanks for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
Pleasure to be here, Andrew.
Chuck, this is a really important topic. It's something that the organization has been focusing on for the last year, and in the last several months this summer, we've been getting really deep into this topic, the Green New Deal and Oregon's forests. And I think it's a timely and inspiring moment to be getting this information out there. There's a broad movement around the Green New Deal. And, you know, you've done a lot of research. You've followed a lot of really important thinkers on this topic. And I was hoping that you would be able to describe the Green New Deal to folks who are listening who maybe have heard of it but don't really understand. You know, there's that term is thrown around a lot in progressive circles in Oregon and across the country, and I think that there's often sometimes some confusion of what we're talking about. You know, there's, you know, say an Oregon Green New Deal, maybe the state's going to invest in protecting forests, but I think it goes a lot deeper than that. What is the national understanding or your understanding by the leaders in this topic of what a Green New Deal is and how it kind of started off with HR 109? What is a Green New Deal?
People are all over the map on what a Green New Deal means. On the one hand, it's a set of words that represents, I guess, anyone's fairly rapid and thorough transformation of the U.S. economy and infrastructure to away from carbon fossil fuel energies to a non-carbon-based, non-fossil fuel-based economy. That's fairly vague, and there's all kinds of strategies and ideas floating around at that end of the spectrum. What I believe is the strategy that should be taken is to do a careful read of what House Resolution 109 says, and then think through or work out how that would apply to our landscape, our state. A Green New Deal is only going to occur under the sponsorship or the leadership of the federal government for reasons that I think we've explored before. Monetary reasons, regulatory reasons, the fact that the federal government basically has the authority over most commerce relations and money. So it's a national, and plus transforming, you can't just transform a place. The transformation has to occur nationally. That kind of federal-led national mobilization, addressing the full suit of elements necessary to be transformed, housing, transportation, energy production, et cetera, the whole industrial infrastructure, it has to occur at a national level. It's just a flurry of activity. The time frame given, I think in 109 and others, what people talk about is 10 years. That's somewhat related to the fact that A, something like that takes 10 or more years, and two, we're racing against time on the drawdown of the carbon budget, where so much carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are put into the atmosphere that we reach certain tipping points and may end up in runaway global warming and Lord knows what. So just the nature of the beast, so to speak, this transformation and the carbon budget drawdown or using up is driving the time frame. That being said, we have to appreciate the national mobilization, which every time that's brought up, it's mentioned equivalent to something like occurred during World War II. We're talking all hands on deck, a full court press. Everything has to be reconfigured and changed. The Green New Deal describes those ambitious goals, sets a target of net zero carbon by 2050, which many think is not enough. Zero carbon by 2050, plus a substantial drawdown of carbon in sequestration is, the scientists will tell you, is part of it. That's the kind of carbon technics, economics, economy end of it. But the Green New Deal also wants to address, has to address, the legacy of race in this country, inequality, class, and all kinds of issues that the New Deal did not. And so the Green New Deal obviously takes its name from the New Deal, the 1930s era rebuilding of so much of the United States, creating new forms of organization and new social enterprise, as seen in many the communication and electrical co-ops that exist, etc. The Green New Deal wants to deal with that legacy. And of course, here we are today. The legacy of racial injustice, racism, is on the front page. It's on the front page every day. It's a clear and present issue, as clear and as present as the climate crisis. So the Green New Deal melds those two needs, those two problems to be solved, justice, equity, and the transformation of the economy. It is so much easier to address chronic long-term social issues when you're rebuilding the house. You know, everything kind of has to change anyway. Why not have a change for the better in a way that works for all people and not just some of the people?
So, of specific interest and something that you're working on right now is describing how forests in Western Oregon play into this idea of a national Green New Deal. Something we say regularly in our communications is that these wet forests in the Pacific Northwest, the Coast Range forests, are some of the best in the world per acre at storing carbon. Can you dive a little bit into the forest piece and how it interconnects with all these other issues, the justice issues, and some of these ideas that you're putting together for how a Green New Deal can, this forward vision on a Green New Deal and these forests?
Well, fortunately, I mean, the two forests, we've got three forest components in the Western Oregon. We have public lands mostly made up of federal ownership. It's broken between Bureau of Land, ONC type lands, and the Forest Service. So if you take public lands and set them aside, we can talk about Northwest Forest Plan, the new planning processes that will be unfolding, the just completed BLM plan. Okay, that's one component. It's like half the, a little bit, almost half the landscape. And then we have private forest and private agriculture. The main valleys are agricultural, and then the forest makes up all the rolling hills and mountains east and west of the Willamette Valley, Rogue Valley, Umpqua Valley. So those landscapes, that forested landscape, as our listeners would well know, is one of the most productive in the world. It grows trees. It used to be a landscape of very large forests. And today, as we've talked about for the past 3 years, and is now kind of coming into broad public awareness, it's controlled by a few large industrial corporate owners, most of which are beholden to Wall Street interests. They manage on an intensive regime, small plantation forestry, fairly quick cutting, lost productivity, very overloaded with a road network. All the downside that occurs from this intensive forestry plays out on half the forest estate. And those lands are generally the most fertile for forest growth. So even though the feds might own half and the industrials own 40%, the industrial forest estate is, if you just adjusted those acres by productivity, would be larger than the federal ownership. A lot of the federal ownership is at higher elevation. The trees grow very slow. And a lot of it's just rock and ice when you get really high. So the actions down on the lower private industrial lands, and that's where there used to be the massive big forests. And reestablishing, one of the four pillars of the climate solution is bringing carbon out of the atmosphere. Building up those forests to sequester carbon is the goal that I think everyone would agree. That would be a good thing. Even the political leaders in Salem appreciate it. The timber companies understand it, okay, and they have their response. But if we can grow those forests bigger, grow them larger, we can sequester millions and millions of tons of atmospheric carbon. And that would be our Oregon contribution to the global problem, along with moving away from a fossil fuel economy, which has to happen also.
So there's, you're talking about this private estate, private forest land estate, and there's these different pathways that we can kind of envision moving forward and how to store carbon on the landscape. And I think you have a really, really insightful vision for how those different pathways play out. Do you want to get into some of those, the regulation, taxation, outright purchasing of carbon, a land reform message? What are some of your thoughts on these different opportunities and how they play into a Green New Deal and the mandate for a just transition?
Well, I think that's the key question. when you start thinking about, okay, what would a transformation for Oregon forests look like? Obviously, the buildup of carbon is the goal. No one disputes that. How do you get there? Now, given the current ownership, you could get there in one of three ways. You could regulate it and just require grow trees longer. There are other regulatory things that the state could do. At all points, the industry will resist, but at some point, they might actually have a legal claim that there's some sort of taking occurring. And so the regulatory envelope has a limit to it. Plus, as far as social justice, a just transition goes, regulating down harvest spreads the pain across the company. I mean, if you have less harvest, I guess the billionaires are getting less dividends or profits. Management has got less to do. There might be a few managers that are let go. There's certainly less work on the landscape as far as logging goes, so loggers will be let go. And the reforestation workforce of Mexican and Central American indigenous people would have less work to do, absent any alternative program of work. So that is a distribution of pain that's not equal. A big investor who gets $900,000 instead of $1 million dividend check is a lot different than Hispanic workers who are just out of luck and out of a job. We'd have to be concerned about just a regulatory straightforward approach outside of the sheer political problem it poses. The second way is to use taxation to encourage something or punish something. It's almost like a regulatory approach, except it provides incentives and disincentives for changing your forest management. And it's no different than really just outright paying the companies for their lost opportunity cost of growing timber as a financial commodity, which requires them to cut it fairly early. So if we just paid them the lost opportunity cost to extend the rotation, now that to me is the worst case scenario. Now the reason it's worse from a just transition is if you pay them to do good, that means the millionaire and billionaire investors get all their money. Corporate management gets all their bonus. And then the farther down the chain, workers lose their job. That's not the way I think we should go. Taxation, I'm not sure exactly how it would play out. I imagine it would be similar to outright regulation as far as the pain would be spread across the enterprise. Just paying them keeps the investors whole and puts people out of work, lessens the money into the local communities. So the fourth strategy, which I think is the way to go, is land reform, where, and you got to remember, most of these companies that own these forest lands are in the business of timber. Some of them are in the business of value added then with the timber or exporting it. And they're in the business of selling land. They explicitly sell any land that warrants being sold. So they're very comfortable. Their investors are comfortable with the idea, oh, we sell land. Purchasing the land and reconfiguring it under new, more equitable enterprise where local communities, the workforce, and other populations are folded into the benefit of the enterprise is really the way to go. It is the essence of a just transition, and our ability to increase carbon sequestration rate, I think, would be maximum under that regime, because the benefit of the remaining forestry, plus all the other restoration activities that could go on locally, would compensate for any lost timber revenue. compensate at the level of communities and workers. It doesn't the investors and top management are compensated up front with a buyout. But after that, the enterprise that remains would benefit the local community so much that whatever shortfall occurs from the previous timbering would be made up for by everyone getting a fair and equitable share. That's the path forward. I don't understand why why we have a hard time convincing colleagues that this just makes sense. And one of the reasons might be is that it's so far outside of today's political frame that's been constructed by power. Well, we have to look back a little more in history and realize that social benefit enterprises all around us. Coast Range Association banks at a credit union. I personally bank at a credit union. I buy food at a food co-op. I have been a member of a telephone co-op on the coast. Power on the coast is supplied by public utility districts. You know, I mean, they are 2 cents a kilowatt, cheaper than in the valley where you buy your power from private investor companies. That's a substantial cost saving. So these kinds of social forms of ownership, social forms of management are all around us. They're part of the American tradition. I just think a lot of people forget about them. They're not talked about by political leaders. They're not talked up by political leaders. They're not bragged about as a legacy of progressive eras in the past. We have to think creatively about forests going forward, forest enterprise and purpose. So, many people I know, many of our colleagues are all upset about forest practices in some fashion, and they want to stop a practice. And, the pushback from the industry is total, So forest practices are an outcome of the forest management strategy. The forest management strategy is an outcome of the nature of the enterprise that's doing the timber harvesting, that's doing the forestry. And the nature of the enterprise that's on the land today is Wall Street financial forest enterprise. That's why the management looks the way it does, and that's why these practices, the things that people see that freak them out, occur. Well, that whole enterprise is only possible because it owns land. It controls land. And if you tell me that it would be better to engage this canary-eating cat of an industry and then watch it closely for the next 20, 30, 40 years and maintain control over that canary-eating cat animated by the power of Wall Street, than it would be to do a one-time purchase of significant amounts of forest land and be done with it. Now, it could be that a small change in Salem or some forestry reform is easier than buying some land or buying a lot of land, but they like to sell land. The question is, why don't we have a solution that makes sense over the long term, is robust to the emergency of serious carbon sequestration, and would work in perpetuity, just like our public utility districts, just like the telephone co-ops, just like the credit unions. Social purpose enterprise has never been denigrated by the fools at the University of Chicago Economics Department, if you might have noticed. It is as efficient and does service delivery not only as well as the private companies, the investor companies, it often does it better.
Yeah, it's a really important vision, and I think tying it back to the Green New Deal and this national mobilization, we're talking about, you know, this land reform as a really just and informed path forward that has a precedent. It's not something that we're creating out of thin air. It's something that there's examples, like you're saying, all across the landscape. I think something that is unique, if through a Green New Deal investment in these forests, is along with that investment in that transfer of ownership, there is a requirement for certain public benefits for that forest. You know, you get this land as a, you know, socially responsible enterprise with requirements for carbon buildup and, you know, social purpose.
Well, look at what just happened in April with the Pandemic Care Act from Congress. I think $500 and some billion was made available for these loans to businesses if they keep people on payroll. So at the end of the period, if you can show 941s that showed up, we kept them on the payroll, the loans supposedly will be forgiven. Okay, it'll just be the same thing. You get a grant or a loan or some financial arrangement to purchase large scale amounts of forest land, and then you have to fulfill, probably through a working forest conservation easement, the terms of the financing, where if you, for the next 50 years, build up forest carbon, the debt obligation will be forgiven. End of story. And the benefits and the focus on forest is, to me, the smaller story. The fact that a less intensive forestry would be good for streams, good for water quality, good for water flow, good for this, good for that. That's the smaller story. A different kind of social benefit forestry would be good for people out in the rural areas. It'd be good for the workforce that's working the land now. And it would be a whole new way of life, a good way of life, coupled with the other transformations that the climate crisis are going to mandate. I'll note, the timber industry is organized very specifically. It has the large, it has the investors at the top. It has the big corporate enterprise firm like Weyerhaeuser or whatever. And then below that are this world of subcontractors. They actually do the work. There are some Weyerhaeuser log trucks I see on the road. Most log trucks are independent contractors, either small firms with 4, 5, 10 trucks or sole proprietor trucks. And then with that is that Hispanic or that Mexican Central American reforestation workforce. They're the ones that replant, clear the brush, do the hard work during cold months. And those three elements, these contractors, the contractor workforce for logging, hauling, yarding, and the reforestation workforce, all those folks are hurting currently. They're hurting as the corporate companies screw down ever harder on the contract provisions, on the amount of work for the amount of money they're going to pay.
Chuck, is there, you know, we're running out of time here. Is there anything that we missed that you wanted to make sure we hit before we get people excited and out, getting active in this work?
A new forestry that has, that circulates wealth and income locally, coupled with a new energy system that increases electrical production locally with solar and wind, and a new agriculture in many of our depopulated valleys and current valleys that have enterprise in farming. A new agriculture, new energy, new forestry would reinvigorate the rural landscape in Oregon. It's waiting to happen. The fact that we could open up and resettle many small landowners, landholders, into the Coast Range depopulated areas would be a great benefit. It would bring new kinds of creative people in agriculture, forestry, energy. This is a world that would be, this is an opportunity that we should all embrace. Time is of the essence.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Visit coastrange.org to learn more. Spread the word. There's all sorts of details about this work on our website. You can learn more and join us, volunteer. We really appreciate everyone's supporting this and helping this vision become a reality for Oregon. Hey, Chuck, thank you so much for the time and for this really important thought. I look forward to further discussions on Coast Range Radio.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Driving around, and we would see Nazi skinheads. We'd jump out of the car, and we're like, "Are you white pride? Are you white pride?" And we'd start swinging.
They are part and parcel of the story of Oregon. They are part of the history here, and so.